Hello. Welcome to Growing Wild. I'm Charlotte Petz and you're listening to Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM on radioreverb.com or maybe through your smart speaker. On this month's show, we're having a little look back over the last 12 months. I'm reticent to say highlights because there's no favourites here. They've all been wonderful. It's more of a compilation of some of the interviews that I've done over the last 12 months, just to give you a flavour of the kind of themes and the experiences and the stories. But at the end, there is a little treat, and it's a segment that I haven't yet played out, and it's really lovely, and I think it's a nice ease into thinking a little bit about spring. But first of all, let's have a song. You know how this goes. We always start with a song. And with remembrance in mind, I felt like playing Misty Blue by Dorothy Moore.
Oh, it's been such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind. But I can't. Just the thought of you turns my whole world misty blue.
Misty Blue by Dorothy Moore. It's just a dream. Just a dream, that song. Completely in love with that song. Okay, we've got a lot to get through. So if you've listened to any of my previous compilation-type shows, then you'll know that I don't include those that have been in the most recent shows just because they were just on, you know. We don't really need a recap for that. So I feel like this last year, the interviews seem to have just delved a little bit deeper and we've got to know people a little bit more. It's been a bit more substantial. The kind of chats that I like to have in real life. So I guess it makes sense that that started to happen in the stuff that I create. So I'm going to start with a couple of people. I've kind of split them into vague groupings. And the first couple of people are both doing brilliant things within their communities. And, you know, I think are incredibly inspiring. And the first person we're going to hear from is Sarah Venn. She was on the Let's Get Political show. She works for a company called Incredible Edible in Bristol, amongst many other things, actually. I think you could describe her as a bit of a food activist. She definitely speaks her mind. And this is just a bit of a flavour of the conversation that we had, which within the whole thing ranged from discovering horticulture as a career right through to, you know, how we can start to look at tackling food poverty. It was quite a big chat. But this bit, she just describes a little bit more about what she does with Incredible Edible and why just the simple act of growing your own food can actually be a very political thing to do.
We come together as groups within a community from a real kind of grassroots aspect, and without necessarily asking for permission or whatever, we find sort of bits and pieces of public land that are probably quite lost and unloved, and clean them up and turn them into beautiful and productive gardens.
I read an article that you wrote for Bloom magazine, and you quoted in there something that Ron Finley had said about gardening in the cities, the most political act you can do. Why do you think that?
So, I mean, it's such a complex conversation.
It's a big question, I know.
But, you know, that whole thing of, you know, what we do is we support people to grow food in the middle of the city or by the sides of, you know, roads. And you'll get loads of people go, oh, no, that's not safe. It really is. We make sure it is.
Yeah.
So it's fine.
There's a lot of fear, isn't there? It feels like you have to overcome quite a lot of
fear.
There
is a whole load of fear.
Yeah.
There's a whole load of mythology.
Yeah.
That, of course, is utter, you know, most of it is utter rubbish. You know, if you plant an apple tree, you know, kids will just throw the apples around. Well, they might. You know, yes, they very well might. But also, somebody might actually eat an apple.
Mm.
So, you know, I mean, it is political because what you're actually saying is we don't like what we see, so we're doing something about it. It's political with a little p, which just basically means it's people taking control. It is that thing of people just going, oh, I have got a voice. I can make some change. I you know, I mean, you know, the thing about Incredible Edible is it's not about self-sufficiency. It's not about, you know, saying, oh, if we turn all of our streets over to food growing, we can be, you know, we don't need to worry. Mm. It's about saying, actually, this is a different way. It's about saying our streets don't need to be full of boring landscaping plants that are badly managed.
We all have a voice and we can all make a difference. I think that was the real essence that came out of that conversation with Sarah Venn. She does really some great work and is so driven to make a change and to be useful, I think. And that does seem to be a thread that runs through most of the people who I speak to. The easiest way to find her is probably on Instagram. I think she's on Twitter as well, but her Instagram handle is @SarahLimbach. Check her out, she's interesting. Okay, next we're going to harp back to when I went and hung out with pedal people. Actually, this interview we just did on the phone, and I was very fortunate to be able to then go out with them on the bikes the next week, but that wasn't recorded, that was kind of just for my own experience. Sorry. But it was brilliant, and I'm glad I got to know what it feels like, and it's quite a thing. They go in to selected care homes in Brighton and Hove, and predominantly those that are for people living with dementia. They have these amazing bright red rickshaws, which are kind of front loaders. So the cyclists, who get called the pilot, sit on the seat at the back, and then at the front is where the two people, elders, they like to call them, sit bundled up in blankets and hats and gloves. You know, they're proper wrapped up. And they get a little trip down to the seafront. They go out for about an hour. This project gives me goosebumps. It's just one of the favourite things I've visited. And this is Ellie Hargreave, who pioneered the whole thing, explaining a little bit more about the project and what it brings to those who take part in it.
They are basically a reverse rickshaw. So instead of the passengers being at the back, they're at the front. And this means they're right out on front, which means they get all the interaction with people, children, dogs, passers-by, which brings them literally back into the community, into sight, and it means that they get the interaction. The pilot sits up on the bike behind, and they also get plenty of interaction. The main idea is obviously with the passenger up front. And because you're going at more of a speed, it's you're going at sort of running pace.
Okay.
It means that we can do a much longer adventure in 1 hour with the elders than maybe edging out with a walking frame if they're lucky, or a wheelchair. Most people we see, it's their only outing, and probably 99% come out in their slippers. What we often find is people haven't been on a bike for maybe 60 years.
Goodness.
And that feeling of being on a bike is something quite extraordinary, that, like you say, if you haven't had it for a while, you kind of forget, and you maybe take for granted. But it is a real sense of freedom that's very different to being in a wheelchair, for example. So one of our very first passengers, Shirley, we took out, said, you know, when I go out in my wheelchair, nobody looks at me. Everybody very Britishly casts their eyes away.
I was going to say, it's a very different experience, isn't it? You think, oh,
and
better.
So, you become the centre of attention.
Right.
And people naturally come up to you. And, when we introduce our pilots, all volunteers, when they introduce our passengers and say, oh, you know, would you like to come meet our VIPs, our very important passengers? You know, this is Joan, she's a mere 91, and this is Marjorie, she's just 102. And then, you know, they'll immediately be wowed, because actually many people don't meet people in their 90s very often. So that's a really lovely side to it.
Yeah, yeah. What effects do you see it have on the people that you take out on the bikes?
Well, that's really the best part, so I'm glad you asked. But it's really quite extraordinary. Because of the fresh air, because of the level of stimulation of just simply being outside and moving along at a pace and interacting with people, having the wind in your hair, feeling the elements, seeing and touching and smelling things along the way, whether that's at the allotment or the sea air, has an incredible effect on people's mood. So you see that instantly. But what we also see and hear a lot, and again, because we've built relationships over the last couple of years, from the care homes and their family members, is that people sleep better, and if people are sleeping better, they're going to be less agitated, particularly for people living with dementia, who can really suffer from, you know, anxious mood, often depression. what we then see is they, you know, they're more likely to eat their lunch because they're out and being stimulated and had the fresh air and, you know, feel exercised and stimulated. And then, you know, that then leads to them being calmer, therefore able to participate perhaps in some activities later in the day, whereas they might think, well, so we're not claiming miracles by any means. What we can see is the joy that it brings.
And having gone out with them myself, you really can see the joy that it brings. It's absolutely delightful. You know, these places, these homes aren't full of joy and life, really. And to be able to just go in there and give them that, even, you know, just for an hour a week, it's something. It just feels like something. And again, it's just these people going in and doing something. Ellie Hargreave is an absolute dynamo. And if you want to find out more about that project, then search for Pedal People and it will come up. And, you know, this is, they're all so much of this is charity work. And it costs, I think they estimated it costs £17 to be able to do each of these rides, you know, if you take in all of the costings of the maintenance of the bikes, et cetera, et cetera. £17, it's not a lot. I think there's a lot of us that could probably just tap that donate button and chuck them £20. Okay, let's have a song. It's just a song I like. It's completely irrelevant to any of the projects that I've played so far. Just like it. It's Avalon by Roxy Music.
Now the party's over, I'm so tired. Then I see you coming out of nowhere. Much communication in emotion. Without conversation or a notion.
That's Avalon by Roxy Music. Okay, this next little portion is going to be around those who I've spoken to who use their creativity as their way to connect to nature. So we've had people that go into their communities and use the outdoors to invigorate and to educate. These next couple of people are those that use their creativity to contribute. So our next voice is Emily Stevens. She was the resident artist at Pell's Pool in Lewis this summer. So I found her at poolside, you know, scribbling away, drawing, painting, and you could see that just being outside had really brought quite a lot to her work. So this was a chat that I really enjoyed. It was one that ventured into areas I wasn't expecting it to, and it kind of just became a life chat, really, which a lot of these do. And Emily was very open about the reasons that she came to be an artist and why she chose to kind of follow that passion.
It's the sounds, it's like now you can hear the sounds of the splashes of the water and people chatting and the wind whistling in the trees, and that all brings something else to the drawing. So I'm trying to capture a feeling, really, I think, essentially, rather than, like I said, I don't want to represent, I don't want to be purely representational, I don't want to do these really delicate literal drawings. I could just copy that off a photo. For me, being here is about soaking up the atmosphere and trying to somehow, usually pretty cack-handedly, get that into my paintings, because it's really hard. It's really hard to paint water because it's always moving, it's always changing, and that's part of the fascination for me. Like the sky's always changing, the light's always changing, and I'm trying to work with these things and bring them. You know, sometimes it rains and I've got raindrops in my sketches, and I think that just adds. And also drawing people that are moving around and doing things, like that woman over there, look at her, she's having a shower. That would make such a brilliant sketch. And I'd have to maybe do it in 30, like 10 seconds. Look, she's just about to go.
Yeah.
I try and capture that.
It's little snapshots of life.
Yeah.
What's your background? Are you trained in... Because you're very good. Your drawings are really good. So you must have been doing this for quite some time.
I've done a lot of courses. Like I did art A-level and I wanted to go to art college and I didn't go. I got a place, but I wanted to go to Sussex. It was all a bit of complicated, so I studied other things, and then something quite big happened in my life, and I like got this shock of, oh, we don't know whether we're going to live or die type thing, you know, like
you
or... Oh no, not to me.
Okay.
No, I lost a baby, which was quite, was a late miscarriage, so I think it was that realization of, oh, literally we think we have control over our lives, and then when it comes to the crunch, we don't. Like, really, we don't. So I thought, what would I want to be doing? What do I want to do if I've only got a couple of years left? And I knew, I'd always known I wanted to be an artist, and it just felt, I just went for it. I'm really glad I did, because I'm happier than I've ever been. I mean, more fulfilled than I've ever been. And I'm so jammy. Like, I get to sit here. I get to become here and just paint and draw. It's like the best thing in the world.
That was Emily Stevens. You can see more of her work if you go on Instagram. I'm just giving out Instagram handles because it's probably the easiest thing. Obviously, you can just put these into a search engine as well. But Emily Stevens, and her Instagram is EmilyStevens_art. Have a look at what she creates. I think it's just brilliant. And that whole conversation was really lovely. It was very open and honest about just, yeah, things that can happen to you in life that spin you around and you head off in a direction that maybe you weren't planning to, which comes up again later in the show, actually, with a couple of interviews I did. It comes up all the time, really, doesn't it? Because it's just life. It happens to all of us. I'm going to stay on point here and just carry on with this vague kind of creativity theme. Obviously, there was Jane Mutiny, who I spoke to, but that was really quite recent, and her work's brilliant. She does these great murals, but she wasn't on that long ago. So she's not in this compilation, but she's amazing. Check her out too. But the show I'm going to go back to is maps. My love for maps knows no bounds, and I wanted to learn a little bit more. It turns out I really didn't know much about them at all, about the creation of them. I just want to play this little moment that I had with Helen Can, who's an illustrator and, you know, creates these beautiful maps. And I went round to her flat with a horrible cold, and San had a chat about it all. And she was very patient with me and my slightly buffoonish questions. But yeah, there was a real moment of realisation, and I love this little bit in our conversation. So this is me and Helen Can.
When I first left university, I worked in a print shop that sold lots and lots of 17th century maps, and that was a kind of high point of map making. And what I really loved about it was that you could tell the difference between one map maker and another by his handwriting, because obviously everything was written by hand. And by the way, he was drawing and the sensitivity of the line that he was using and the kind of information that he was putting down. So every time somebody hand draws a map, they've edited it and curated what they've seen. They've decided what's important enough to put in the map.
And that's true of even these maps that were being made.
Of course.
Just a map of town, they would highlight the bits that they liked best.
Or were most important.
Most important.
And it might be to do with their patron and what their patron thought was important.
So in that way, do they almost write history a little bit? Because some stuff just would never have been documented if the map maker wasn't that interested in it.
Exactly.
Wow. So it's a huge part of history.
Yes. But that's why they're so fascinating.
There we go. Maps make history. Who knew? Probably everybody, actually. Someone else who featured in that show was Emily McCauley of This Way Maps. And her friend Felicity have created this lovely company where they make their own maps. They go out hiking and then they create their own maps with little detail on there that they find interesting. So me and Emily went for this little walk up on the downs by Kingston, I think it was. And she was talking to me a little bit more about what kind of things they put into their maps, what they're interested in. And it was really lovely. It was a really lovely chat. And this is just a little flavour of it.
I've always loved maps, like since I started trying to plan longer routes, kind of 5 or 6 years ago, really wanting to open up the Sussex countryside around where I was living. And I remember having a conversation with someone that said they hated maps because they found that it restricted. It was like bossing them around. You have to stay on this footpath. And I've always found the complete opposite, and I've discussed this with Felicity, that we think it opens up a place. So if I don't have a map of an area, I don't know where a footpath leads to, so I'm not necessarily going to take it. And I find that a map shows you the limitless possibilities of moving through a landscape. So a real appreciation of that. So we'll go to the location, figure out that it's a nice place to hike, maybe do the route once and then go back and test it properly and then come back and map it, which doesn't take very long at all. The data mainly exists, so there's lots of open source mapping stuff, so it's just a case of converting that and illustrating it ourselves. But the main amount of time is going and checking that the footpaths are where they say they are and that the route is actually a nice one and you're not going to encounter private woodland or stuff like that. The longer maps that we do, so ones like our Brighton to Lewes one, they take a bit longer because they're longer routes. You kind of need to test more of the footpaths, and there's a number of points of interest. So we have multiple things, stories that we want to research. And
okay. Oh, so yeah. That's all included as well? You do little bits of local knowledge and things?
Yeah. We like to think that they're the more boring and unusual tourist attractions.
Okay, such as? Between Brighton and Lewes, what have you highlighted on the way?
So some of them are really personal things. So when
the Brighton... Wee and stuff. Wild wee spot over
this
here.
This is a really good spot. It's private.
It's important to know that sort of thing.
It is very actually important. Yeah. So one of the ones that I always think about with the Brighton map, because that was our first one, was actually just over the hill from here, in between Brighton and Lewes, there's this valley. And in summer, the crops grow, and you are sometimes the one responsible for cutting the path. And you kind of walk through the crops and they're kind of up to your knees. And it was just a really lovely experience that both me and Felicity had had separately. And we've put that on the map as like you have to go there at specifically the right time of year, which neither of us could remember the exact date. But it was just this really nice shared experience that we both had separately. So those kind of things are on there. Lewes bonfire. If there's some geological structure, that's the best thing for us, or some folklore or a ghost story. They're the things that we love the most.
They really do make lovely maps, and you can find them again if you Google This Way Maps. I said Google. I've been trying to avoid saying Google. If you put into your search engine This Way Maps, then they will come up, and they're lovely. And I really did enjoy that conversation. I just do love the way that people use their creativity to then go out and connect in nature, and there's many ways of doing that, and that's just such a small portion of the ways to do it. But I thought, just leading on from the whole going for walks and maps and things, I wanted to put in my little pilgrimage I did with Will Parsons from the British Pilgrimage Trust. I'd just got back from going on quite a long walk, something I'd never done before. It was solo wild camping. And it was, sort of several days in a row. And it was really quite a profound experience for me. And I wanted to then speak to someone else who knew more about that and could maybe help me replicate such an experience, but on a smaller scale, and what that actually meant, and to explore the word pilgrimage a little bit. Because there's this whole history of how Britain was actually covered in these pilgrimage routes, but Henry VIII shut them all down when he came along and burnt all of records to do with the pilgrims and everything. Who had been part of them and any ritual or ceremony that would have happened to do with them. So Will and his merry team are trying to reclaim that and are bringing these routes back. So I went to go and meet him. This is a mini portion of the micro pilgrimage that we went off and did.
So what I'd really like us to do today is make a micro pilgrimage to a holy well that has been covered by the spring tides and is now buried under shingle. It's the holy well of an area called Holywell. And it is at the foot of Eastbourne, just between the town and the South Downs. And this is a very ancient holy well that is both rising from below and is also sinking through the chalk cliffs. There was a convent built just above it, and some people say that this is the whole reason Eastbourne is here in the first place. Water, fresh, flowing, potable water, healing water, being crucial infrastructure for life on Earth. Much like the British Pilgrimage Trust is doing a pilgrimage to uncover it, you and I today, Charlotte, are going to uncover the Holy Well of Holywell and hopefully get our hands in it, hopefully drink from it. We might as well get comfy. This will take a while. It's not easy on the hands already. Look, do you see? I see water.
There's definitely water there.
I see water.
It's mushy.
All of this is going to fall in.
It is.
It really is. You climb one hill, go down, and then there's another hill. Oh my goodness. Look.
At that.
Hang on, not just water. Wait, it's holy water. Wow. I mean, that's what's taken us half an hour of digging.
Yeah.
We've got sort of 5 centimetre by 5 centimetre holy puddle. So what we're going to do now, Charlotte, is the water's running clear, so we are going to filter some.
Okay.
And drink it. But the first thing I think we should both do is give a gift. So I'm actually just going to go and grab some silver. Silver's antimicrobial, antibacterial. It doesn't kill the aquatic life. You chuck in a tuppenny piece now, it's full of nickel and copper, and it harms the water. You know, it's a classic example of us doing things wrong, meaning well, but the road to hell paved with good intent. It costs about the same as a lottery ticket. It's a 2 quid piece of silver.
It looks a little bit like a watch battery.
Water like silver, shiny things. So we're going to give it as a gift. But first of all, we're going to make a wish on it. So now I've got this amazing filter. This is absolutely potable, delicious, holy well water.
I'm going in. Cheers.
Go well.
It's chalky.
Yeah.
It's not at all unpleasant.
And that is the holy well water of Holy Well Eastbourne. Cheers.
There we go. I didn't put in the bit where I sang this time. I thought I'd spare you from that, doing that again. It was quite uncomfortable for everybody involved. Do go back and have a little listen to that, though. I did really like it. I think you can find that if you search from wherever you get podcasts. The show is called We're Going In. And he's such an interesting guy, and he's doing a really brilliant thing. So have a listen back. I think you'll like it. Okay, let's have a song. Let's break this up a little bit, have a song, and then come back with the next round of Marvellous Humans. This is Blue Moon by She Keeps Bees.
Blue moon, you saw me standing alone, without a dream in my heart, without a love of Blue Moon.
That was Blue Moon with She Keeps Bees. You're listening to Growing Wild. I'm Charlotte Petz, and this is Radio Reverb. We're doing a little bit of a compilation show for this session. Yeah, I think listening to other people's stories can be so helpful to ourselves, because, you know, we all go through stuff, we all struggle, and sometimes pretending that you're not is just exhausting, isn't it? So when people are bold enough and brave enough to tell their story, I think it's such a privilege to be able to hear that. And Lily Gom, for me, was one of those people. She is a gold-winning Chelsea designer. And we kind of just became friends, I guess, and I started to learn a little bit more about her history. And just thought it was just really quite incredible what she's come from to what she's managed to do with that and to go on to achieve. Because it was really around the loss of her dad that then brought her into the garden. She stopped doing what she was studying, which was architecture, and her life just took this massive kind of turn. And it turned out that actually being in the garden and plants were her real love. But unfortunately, it took some pretty horrible events to find that out. Anyway, here's a little segment of mine and Lily's chat.
My dad was just a lover of gardening, and I could always see how happy it made him. He was always happiest with, like, weeding with one hand and a beer in the other. just so content. So that's what I grew up with. But it was really after he passed away that I came back to the garden. And it was a real turning point. And ever since then, I just sort of figured out that I could do that every day, and plants were my real passion, and I'd got it wrong previously.
Okay, so it's something that you used to do with your dad, and then he passed away, and then you went straight back into the garden. Was that to help you kind of just to remind you of him? Did it feel like a connection to him? Or was it that it was outside and that it gave you a bit of space?
Well, after he passed away, and the following summer, like, the garden looked awful. And it's just, there were more things that were slowly, I was realising that I'd lost as a result of losing that person as well. And that connection to nature was one of them. So as it looked so bad, I thought I'd have to get out there myself and do something about it. And that's, I really sort of almost found peace and quiet in the garden in a time which was quite turbulent. I'd spent the past few years, I'd lost a few family members, many things had gone wrong, and it was like white noise in a way. And no one else that I knew liked gardening, so they left me to it, and it was just quiet and what I needed. It was cathartic. I loved it. And I think when I did lose him, we also lost all the stuff that came with the garden. So the first thing I did was start growing runner beans, because they were always sort of a part of my childhood that I hadn't really thought much about. But when they're suddenly taken away and you don't have these moments, I needed to recreate them. So I started growing them myself. And that first time a plant died, I remember standing in the potting shed and just crying because it just, I don't know, it just made it, everything feel okay, which is quite strange seeing as you're killing a plant, but not intentionally.
That was Lily, and you can find her on Instagram as well, at Lily Gom, and that's GOMM. She really taps in there to how I think the rhythm of nature can just be so soothing and such a tonic when your life is so turbulent and just being chucked around. There's this constant that is happening. The sun rises and the sun sets. Plants live, plants die. There's a real rhythm that we can tune into, and I think is a real theme, you know, of this show, really. You know, nature is this wonderful balm to our spirit. The next person whose interview I'd like to recap is Raina Wynn. She's the author of the brilliant book called The Salt Path, which is a story of how her and her husband lost their home and just didn't really know what to do themselves. They're in their 50s and just packed a backpack and went and walked the Southwest Coast Path down in Cornwall. I met her at a literary festival, the Wealden Literary Festival, and we sat on a bench by this little pond and had a lovely chat. This is a story really of how tuning into those rhythms really, really helped her and her husband to kind of feel all right again.
So you wild camped all of it, most of it, all of it?
All of it.
Yeah, yeah. Which is such a different way of, that in itself is such a different way of experiencing anything, because you're completely immersed in nature, and there's no separation, you know, even on a campsite, which is still outside and all of that, it's still quite sanitized. Mm. How has your experience and relationship with nature changed, and, you know, has it been massively kind of enriched and deepened as a result of, or is that something that you had anyway?
I think to an extent I had it anyway, because I grew up on a farm. I lived a very rural life, so I was always in the natural environment. So to a degree, I think wild and natural environment really was my safe place. Mm. It was the place I would go to when life didn't go the way you wanted it to. But wild camping on those cliffs, that was a wholly different experience, because you weren't just living alongside nature or in nature, you were part of it. You were absolutely part of everything that went around you. And just having those couple of layers of tent around you didn't separate you from the badger coming in through the tent flaps, or waking in a meadow where there are just thousands of ladybirds hatching into the first flight. And I think it was those magical, close moments with nature that allowed us to heal, really, because we may have had no home, we may have had absolutely nothing materially, but when we opened those tent flaps every day, we had it all. Mm. We had everything. Mm. And to just wake on a foggy headland, to hear the seals calling to each other in the coves below as the lights coming up, just lighting the headlands one by one, that's really intense in that connection to the natural world. Mm. And that allowed us to re-find our sense of self-belief.
Did you get any more spiritual? You know, because there's all these lovely stories that happened along the way when you felt really bad. I remember one that you wrote about where you hadn't had any water and it was so hot, it was like 37 degrees, and you saw on the map that there was a stream and a toilet, but the toilet was locked and the stream had run dry. I can't do it. And then someone came along and said, oh, I'm just 20 minutes up the road to have a lolly and come and have dinner. You know, things like that kind of happen quite a lot. Yeah, did you start sort of trusting something else in a way?
Well, a few people have asked me that. And it's quite tricky. I mean, I have no religious belief whatsoever. Yeah. And I wouldn't have called myself a spiritual person. Yeah. But I think give yourself up to life and things will come. That if I came out of it with any belief at all, it was probably that allow life to be and things will come to you.
Ah, a beautiful sentiment to end that on, I think. Her book is wonderful and she's got another one coming out quite soon. She's Raina Wynne and you can find her on Instagram at Raina Wynne or just search for her. Her and her husband's story is one that it really stayed with me for a long time. It's strong. And to go through, you know, such a horrible event as losing your home and her husband got very poorly as well, and to come out of it and have such a philosophical view on it as just let life happen and life will come to you. I mean, that's quite a thing, I think. So I'm going to end the show with a piece that I haven't played out on this show, actually. It's a bit I made for the BBC, and it is with Kate Bradbury, who's been on a few times across the shows. And we did a little piece about the Dawn Chorus down on her allotment, and I just thought, you know, we're pretty much in the middle of winter. It's nice to know that these little birdies will soon be back and tweeting away, and spring will do its thing and life starts re-emerging. Although I do like winter. I think it's really important to have this hibernation period and just rest and just allow it. It's good. It's good for the soul. So this is me and Kate whispering and creeping around and whispering and listening in to what birds we could hear. I've come down to Weald Allotments with nature writer Kate Bradbury to come and have a listen to the Dawn Chorus. It's just past dawn. There's still a little bit of pink in the sky. It's a touch cloudy, but the birds are still singing. They've been quite vociferous. Kate, why is their bird song so prolific in May?
Because this is their peak breeding time. So birds, they are pretty much all breeding now. The females will be sitting on eggs or they'll have chicks in the nest. They set up their breeding territories as early as December, just after the winter solstice. And you might hear, on a cold winter's afternoon, you might hear a little great tit just practicing its song, teacher, teacher, teacher. And then gradually, over the course of the next few weeks, more birds start tentatively singing. And then you get blackbird in March and a song thrush. And then they all come together at dawn. And then dawn chorus gradually gets louder from about March as more birds join in and they sing. They start singing tentatively. They start sort of just throwing out a little song here and there to see what's going on. And then gradually they start singing every morning until you get to May. And the first week of May is thought to be the peak time of birdsong.
I mean, we're somewhere, I guess, fairly urban. It's a lovely big green patch in the middle of Hove, West Hove.
Mm-hmm.
I can hear quite a few different voices going on. What can we hear?
Right now I can hear a blackbird. Many blackbirds, actually. Blackbirds have got a really fluty, rich song. We've got herring gulls, obviously, in Brighton.
Always the dominant voice.
That was a wren just there. Wren's got an amazing, amazing song. Oh, look, there it is. Just there in the tree.
I find this time of year, about 4 o'clock, they start. I mean, and it's loud and it's noticeable. And
And they seem to come in at different stages through the morning. What's the first thing you're likely to hear?
They do. It's usually the robin that sings first. The birds with the biggest eyes. So the robin sings first, shortly followed by the wren and the blackbird. Those are the birds that you find on your lawn or sort of poking about in your borders in the morning, and they feed from the ground and they eat worms. The early bird gets the worm. And then they're joined by tits, song thrush, wood pigeons, until at about sort of 6 a.m. you've got this cacophony of birds all going for it at the same time. And then those early birds go off and eat worms while the others are still singing.
If we stand under another tree, maybe, do you think we'll hear other varieties?
Could do. Let's go and stand under that thicket over there.
Okay. Why have you brought me down to your allotment instead of just a back garden or maybe...
It's a linnet.
There.
Could be a linnet. It could be a white throat. We also get white throats. The Weald allotments, there's so much, like it's such a huge space and there's so many trees that it's just a really wonderful place to come. And especially in Brighton and Hove, you know, that the habitats of our gardens can be quite depleted. There's not many trees. A lot of people use paving or decking. And there's no habitats for birds, or there's few habitats for birds. You might get a few sparrows or a couple of blue tits. But here in the allotment, you've got such a rich diversity, and so you just get a better dawn chorus. You just need trees for birds. Plant trees and the birds will come.
I've been reading a bit lately about how just coming down to listen to the dawn chorus can be a real boost for well-being. Would you agree with that? Do you think it's something... I mean, it feels so accessible. All we have to do is wake up early in the morning. We just have to get up.
When that alarm goes off at 4:30, you know, you don't want to get out of bed. But I knew this morning that it would be good. And I got to the allotment and I saw 2 swifts, my first swifts of the year. And then just standing here listening to the birds, I feel well. And it's a lovely way to wake up. It's just a lovely thing to do, just once a year, just to make the effort to just get up. And if you don't have an allotment, then go and sit in your garden and see which birds you can attract. Or go to your nearest park.
And sometimes, you know, hearing all these different bird songs, we don't necessarily know what they are. And it can be quite difficult to learn it. How would you recommend that people just began to learn their bird song?
I think paying more attention to birds in the first place is a really good starting point. Sorry, the song thrush is just starting up. Which is my favourite.
You're welling up.
Yeah, just paying more attention. So, you know, in the background we can hear the fluty blackbird, which is a real easy one to start with. Aujourd'hui.
Kate thinks the blackbird here is French, just to let you in on that.
And you know, the robin sings sort of all through the day, all through the year, so that's a really good one to start with as well. And that sort of sounds like a little trickling, babbling brook. But there's an app you can download called Garden Birds. I mean, it's not very romantic, but, you know, download an app on your phone and listen. And then, you know, when you hear birds out and you're like, oh, what's that bird? And just play it on your app. And sometimes, if you play the bird song on your app, then the birds will sing back to you, which is gorgeous.
No way.
Yeah. Because the whole reason they sing, you know, it's males being territorial and aggressive. I mean, we think this bird song sounds beautiful, and, you know, as human beings, we've evolved with bird song, and it, you know, it lifts a part of us. It reconnects us with the landscape. But for the birds themselves, it's war. It's, you know, this is my tree, this is my missus, get off. And, you know, they're hugely territorial. And so if you're just in a park or in your garden thinking, oh, what's that lovely bird song? And then you play a bit of your app, birds will sing back. The birds will be like, oi!
Who's this geezer?
Get off! They just happen to do it in such a beautiful way.
Have you found since learning the bird song that your connection to the birds feels greater because you know what they are? In naming them, do you feel closer to them?
Yeah, just knowing the birds, it just connects you to the landscape. I mean, we humans have evolved with birdsong. It's a part of us. We grew up, we came from the woods, we came from the trees, and so did the birds. And as a living being on this planet, just having birds singing in my ears every spring is, it's a really, it's a powerful thing. It's a lovely thing.
That was Kate Bradbury down on her allotment back in May. You can find her on Instagram at Kate_Bradbury, and she's very prolific on Twitter as well. We've come to the end of the show. I want to say thank you to everyone who's been on over the last 12 months. I say at the end of every show, I just really mean it. I'm so lucky to get to do this and to go and speak to the people that I do and to tap in to these little pockets of goodness. There's quite a maelstrom of crap going on at the moment, and it can get quite bleak and you can feel quite downhearted, I think. And actually, like I think I say all of the time, if you bring it back to a more local level and you look at the actual little steps that we can make and you tune into these people who are doing these things, and there's so much good, there is so much good out there. And it's so heartwarming to be able to experience that and to go and speak to these people. And also, of course, the outdoors and nature and the effect that that has on people and the different ways that people access it and experience it. It's just, it's a joy. It's just a joy. It's a joy to experience. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. I hope that it's something that you continue to enjoy. You can get in touch with me. I am on Twitter and Instagram at growingwildfm. You can email me growingwildreverb@gmail.com or go through the show's website, which is radioreverb.com. Click on shows and find Growing Wild. Within that, there's a little contact page. I'm going to play you out with a song which is called This Feeling by Alabama Shakes. Go well as we head into this new year, and I'll be back soon.
So I just kept dreaming. Yeah, I just kept dreaming. It wasn't very hard. I spent all this time trying to figure out why nobody on my side. See, I've been having me a real